Chapter 11. The Long Peace. When a man comes home from war, the first mercy is that the door opens. The second is harder. He must learn to live inside the house again. I had thought of Moundville from camps and boats, from the sand of Alabama and the mud of Louisiana, from guard posts and trenches and floors where a coat served for a pillow. I had made a picture of it in my mind so many times that, when I came at last through the actual door, the place seemed both familiar and strange. Janet was there. The children were there. The household had not been waiting in stillness. It had been living. That was what I had to learn first. A soldier away from home thinks often of what he has left. He may imagine that his return will set everything back into its old order, as if absence were a gate that swings shut behind him and leaves no mark. But a farm does not stop growing weeds because a man is at the front. Children do not stay the size they were when he kissed them goodbye. A wife does not cease from labor and fear because the army has taken her husband. Janet had kept the place, and she had kept the children, and she had kept herself before God through the months when no order of mine could help her. Lizzie was no longer only the little daughter of my first sorrow, the child left to me by Elizabeth Ellison when death took her mother in the spring of 1857. She had lived through my service under Janet's care. James, Sarah Ann, and Eddie had also grown in the time I was away. They knew me and did not know me. That is one of the wounds war gives a father without drawing blood. A child may come to him gladly and still look with the eyes of one measuring whether the man before her is the same man whose name has been spoken in prayers, letters, and anxious household talk. I had to earn back the commonplace of father, not by some grand act, by days, by being present when bread was cut, when wood was brought, when a child was corrected, when a prayer was said, when weather threatened, when work needed hands. In the army, a man is counted on a roll. At home, he is counted in a thousand smaller ways, and each one matters. The first months after my return were full of ordinary things, and ordinary things can be the hardest to receive after long disorder. I woke without the drum. I slept without expecting an order. I put my hands to work that was my own work again. There were fences, stock, fields, accounts, neighbors, church duties, family duties. There was the weight of being a husband, not by letter, but by presence. There was the old Baptist habit of ordering life before God, not merely in danger, but in peace. I had been baptized in the Fox River at Moundville in April of 1852, long before the war. That water had marked a life I did not yet know, would include the Red River, Bailey's Dam, Spanish Fort, Fort Blakely, Mobile, and the long road home. After the war, faith was no less necessary because bullets no longer passed over me. It may have been more necessary. In battle, a man prays because death is plain. In peace, he must pray because life is long and duty does not announce itself with gunfire. Moundville held the first chapter of my return, but it did not hold the rest of our lives. In 1867, we moved the family to Waverly, Iowa. Janet's obituary would later remember that journey by team and wagon, and that it took 15 days. A line like that is easily passed over by a reader, but 15 days with a family and goods by wagon is no small thing. It meant weather, roads, children tired of jolting, stops to feed and water teams, meals contrived as they could be, nights under uncertain shelter, and the constant question of whether what had been chosen was wise. I had traveled thousands of miles in the army by railroad, steamboat, and foot. That movement was different. In service, a soldier goes because he is ordered. In a family move, a man goes because he has chosen a future and has brought his wife and children under the burden of that choice. I felt that difference. Every mile west and south into Iowa was a mile made not by command, but by responsibility. Waverly was the first Iowa home. The country was not strange in the way Alabama had been strange, but it was not Moundville. Iowa had its own soil, its own towns, its own Baptist meetings, its own neighbors, its own claims upon a man. We farmed. We made our way. The children found the shape of the new place more quickly than I did, perhaps because children belong to the present more easily than their elders. They remember, but they also grow into what is before them. A new place asks questions of a man. Who are your people? What church do you attend? What work can you do? Are you honest in a bargain? Will you appear when neighbors need help? The army had answered one set of questions about me, but peace asked another set, and it asked them slowly. A reputation after the war was not made by saying one had served. It was made by paying what was owed, keeping one's word, speaking truthfully, laboring when labor was required, and letting neighbors see the same character in winter that they had seen in summer. I do not mean that soldiering counted for nothing. Men respected service, especially when the graves were still fresh and the uniforms still hung in trunks. But a uniform could not plow a field in 1867. It could not comfort a child, plant corn, mend harness, lead Sunday school, or sit with a sick neighbor. The war had given me memories. Peace demanded conduct. In those years, the family increased. Martha Janet, called Nellie, had been born after my return. Then more children came. William C., Mary Margaret, William Carey, Hume John, Cora May, Ruth Gertrude, and Lou Eva. The records count names and years. A father remembers more than the count. He remembers the cry of a newborn in a house that already seems full. He remembers the mother's weariness and strength. He remembers older children being asked to help, small clothes, sickness watched through the night, a child's first steps, the fearful quiet before a fever breaks. Not every child given to a house remains in it. William C., born in 1868, died in infancy the next year. There is no way to make such a fact smaller by placing it in a line of genealogy. A little boy came and was gone. We had already known death in the house. Elizabeth Ellison had died within days of Lizzie's birth. War had taken comrades. Disease had taken soldiers in the South by the hundreds. Yet the death of a child is not less because a man has known other griefs. It enters the house and changes the sound of it. We later had another son named William Carey. That name carried both memory and hope. Families sometimes repeat a name not because they have forgotten the child who died, but because they have not. The second child is not the first child restored. He is himself. Yet the name speaks across the absence. In 1874, we settled on a farm near Clarksville in Butler County, Iowa. That place held us longer. 18 years near Clarksville is a substantial portion of a life. A man who has been moved by war and then by migration learns the value of staying. Staying has its own labor. It asks for seasons repeated, debts met, neighbors known, children raised into the duties of work and faith, and a name made steady enough that others trust it. I farmed because farming had been the substance of my life before the war and remained so after it. The earth does not ask whether a man has served in the army. It asks whether he will work. A field is not moved by old stories. It must be plowed, planted, tended, harvested. Stock must be cared for. Weather must be endured. Tools break. Markets change. A man learns humility from such things if he has not already learned it elsewhere. I also taught school for some years. There is a great difference between standing in a line of soldiers and standing before children with books. Yet there is discipline in both, and patience is needed in both. A rural schoolmaster does not command as an officer commands. He must hold attention, correct without cruelty, encourage what is weak, and keep order among children whose families know one another and whose lives will continue after the school day ends. I had known letters as a lifeline in war. teaching made letters part of the piece. Reading, writing, figures, recitation, the habits by which children entered a larger world, these were quiet works, and quiet works are not small. The church remained central. I served in Baptist Sunday school work, and the record remembers me as superintendent of Sunday schools. That phrase carries more than an office. It means gathering children and adults under Scripture, arranging lessons, encouraging attendance, finding teachers, keeping order, caring whether the young knew more than the names of faith. A soldier may fight for a union, but a Christian father and churchman must labor for souls one by one. I do not say I did that work perfectly. I say it mattered to me. There were civic duties, too. I served as township assessor, a role that required entering the ordinary material facts of neighbors' lives: land, stock, property, value, tax. It was not heroic work, and for that reason it belonged exactly to peace. A township is held together by such unglamorous offices. Someone must count fairly. Someone must keep books. Someone must be trusted enough to do what others may grumble at, but still accept as necessary. I kept books for a community organization as well. Ledgers have their own moral weight. A mistake in a book can become a quarrel between neighbors. A clean account is a service. I had seen in the army how much depends upon rolls, returns, papers, and the proper entry of a man's name. In peace, the papers are different, but the duty to be exact remains. Years passed. That is a short sentence for what took a lifetime to live. The children grew into their own lives. Lizzie, the daughter of my first marriage, came of age in Iowa. In 1880, she married Albon Briggs Shadbolt at Shell Rock. A father's feelings at a daughter's marriage are not easily set down. She had come into the world with death beside her. She had been mothered by Janet, raised among brothers and sisters of the second marriage, carried west with the family, and grown into womanhood. To give her into marriage was to see the child of Elizabeth Ellison's brief life step into a life of her own. Janet's place in that story should not be hidden. She did not bear Lizzie, but she raised her. By every practical measure of childhood, Janet was the mother in the house. A family made by second marriage is sometimes too neatly described by records, as if blood alone explains the bonds in a kitchen, at a sickbed, in a school lesson, at a table, in prayer. It does not. Love and duty, repeated long enough, become a family fact.
What the record does not preserve from Janet's voice in these years: if peace had a sound in our house, it was not silence. It was Janet moving before the day had fully opened, seeing what needed to be done and doing it. It was her voice calling a child back from carelessness, softening when the child was hurt, strengthening when there was no room for complaint. It was the sound of her making room in a household for the child I had brought from my first grief and for the children God gave us together. No letter from those ordinary married years remains here to quote her. The record gives her dates, her children, the journey by wagon, the long marriage, and the fact that she had cared for five children while I served. But a wife is not made of facts only. I knew the steadiness behind them. I knew the woman who had lived the war from home and then lived the peace without asking to be named for every burden she carried.
The war did not leave me because I lived quietly. It returned in ways that did not always announce themselves. A smell of damp earth could bring back Louisiana. Pine smoke could bring back the march toward Mobile. A steamboat whistle, if heard along a river or remembered from one, could open again the long decks and crowded transports of the service. A child crying at night could become for one breath the cry of a wounded man, and then be only a child again, needing a father. There were public remembrances, too. After the war, Veterans found one another in organizations, in reunions, in Decoration Day observances, in newspaper notices, in the naming of battles that civilians often knew only as dates. The Grand Army of the Republic gave many men a place to stand with others who did not need the whole story explained. A veteran could say Vicksburg, Red River, Spanish Fort, Blakely, Mobile, and another veteran would understand that each name held more than a line in a history book. Decoration Day came into the years after the war as a solemn habit. Graves were decorated, speeches were made. Children learned to connect flowers with sacrifice. Some of the dead lay near enough to be visited. Others lay far away in the south, in graves their families never saw. A cemetery in Iowa or Wisconsin could never hold all the men a veteran carried in mind, but it could give the living a place to enact remembrance. What the record does not say. On one Decoration Day, I stood among graves while children moved with flowers in their hands. The day was mild. The grass had the fresh look of late spring, and the flag set by the graves moved when the wind came across the cemetery. A speaker's voice carried for a while and then was taken by the air. I heard the familiar words, Union, sacrifice, liberty, duty, the honored dead. I looked at the children more than at the speaker. They knew the ceremony before they knew the cost. That is as it should be. The young receive memory first as form, and only later, if God gives them years, as understanding. I thought of Peter LaFleur, killed in the Red River fighting, far from the Portage country that had known him. I thought of men whose names I had heard called in camp and then not heard again. I thought of graves under southern ground and of bodies never brought north. I thought of the mothers and wives who had not been able to stand where their dead lay. A flower on an Iowa grave could not reach them all. Yet I stood there with my hat in my hand and believed the act was not empty. We decorate what we can reach, and the Lord knows the rest. The peace after war was not free of political trouble. But this chapter is not the place for me to claim knowledge I did not have. I was not a statesman. I did not sit in Washington. I knew the country through newspapers, neighbors, church, work, and memory. I knew that the Union had been preserved. I knew that slavery had ended in law. I knew that many questions remained beyond the power of one Iowa farmer to settle. Like most men, I lived the nation through the duties immediately before me. Those duties multiplied as children grew. A house with many children is a school in patience, economy, fairness, and surrender. Food disappears quickly. Clothing passes from one child to another. Shoes wear out. A younger child wants what an older child has earned. An older child must learn that strength is given partly for service. Parents must correct without breaking the spirit, comfort without indulging every complaint, and pray over decisions no record ever preserves. Some of our children left for households of their own. Some remained near. Some went farther. That is the ordinary scattering of a large family. In the army, separation comes by command. In family life, it comes by maturity. Marriage, work, and providence. A father who has longed for home must learn that home itself is not a fixed company. It changes membership as children grow and go. The death of Janet's mother in 1876, and the deaths of others in the older generation, reminded us that we had become the middle, and then the elder ones. James Hume, Janet's father, lived until 1887. My own father and mother had belonged to the Lancashire world from which I had departed as a young man. By the post-war decades, that old world lived in memory and in family names more than in daily presence. I was an English-born man, a Wisconsin soldier, and an Iowa farmer. A life can be all of those things without ceasing to be one life. By the 1880s, the war was far enough behind us that young people could think of it as history. and near enough that men my age could still feel it in the bones. I had not been a boy when I enlisted. That mattered. I had gone at 32, already a husband and father, already formed by work, faith, loss, and immigration. When the 1880s came, I was not yet old, but I was old enough to know that the war had divided my life into before and after. I sometimes wondered whether the younger people understood what they had inherited. They had roads, farms, schools, churches, markets, and county business proceeding under one flag. They had arguments, as every generation has arguments, but they did not have to watch states leave the Union or hear that an army had been raised to restore it. Perhaps no generation can truly understand the cost paid before it was old enough to pay. That is why older men speak, even when younger ears grow tired, not to make themselves great, but to keep the price from vanishing. There were men in Iowa who had worn gray in the war, or who had kin who had done so, and there were many who had worn blue. The country was large enough to contain both memory and discomfort. I did not live my peace by rehearsing hatred. A farmer has too much to do for that, and a Christian has no warrant to make bitterness his daily bread. But neither did I think forgetting was a virtue. Forgiveness and forgetfulness are not the same thing. The Union dead did not die so that the living could pretend no question had been decided. When I met another veteran, there was often a brief measuring between us. What regiment? What state? Where did you serve? A man might answer with one place name and reveal a whole region of suffering. Vicksburg, Shiloh, Atlanta, the Wilderness, Mobile, Red River. We did not always tell stories. Sometimes the place name was enough. Sometimes it was safer than the story. The older I grew, the more I understood that the army had given me a second kind of kinship. It did not replace family. Nothing replaces wife, children, church, and home. But it remained. The men who had marched with me knew something of my life that even Janet could know only by love and imagination. Janet knew what my absence cost. She did not know the exact weight of the knapsack and sand, the sound of the axework at Bailey's Dam, the look of men before a charge, or the feeling of waking in Mobile without knowing that the greatest news of the war was already traveling toward us. Other soldiers knew those things in their own versions, and that knowledge made a bond even among men who had never served in the same company. Lizzie's marriage in 1880 stood near the center of that after. She became Mrs. Shadbolt and made her own household. Other children followed their courses. Sarah Ann, James, Edward Robert Wilson, Nellie, Mary, William Carey, Hume John, Cora, Ruth, and Lou Eva each carried a part of the family into years I could not control. A father names them, but God numbers their days. Lou Eva, born in 1880, was the youngest of the named children in our records. She died in 1891 at 11 years of age. I will not make a scene where the record gives only the blow. I will say that losing a child after the war was not made easier by having survived the war. Grief does not respect chronology. The country may call a man veteran, but in the room where a child has died, he is simply a father. The farm near Clarksville held us until 1892, when we moved to Charles City in Floyd County. A move later in life is not the same as the wagon journey of 1867. By then, we had decades behind us in Iowa. We had buried, married, taught, farmed, served, and aged. To move to Charles City was to begin another form of settlement, not the raw beginning of youth, but the deliberate turn of established years. Charles City was a larger place than the farms and small settlements that had shaped much of our life. We farmed there until 1910, but that belongs beyond the boundary of this chapter. In the 1890s, I was a man in his 60s. The children were no longer the little company Janet had tended while I was away at war. Some had households, Some had paths leading away from our table. The noise of the house changed. The labor changed. Memory grew louder in proportion as daily urgency lessened. There is a silence that comes when a house empties by degrees. It is not the silence of grief exactly, though grief may be in it. It is the sound made when children have become adults and the rooms no longer hold the same daily tumult. Janet and I had lived through the crowded years, when there was scarcely time to think before another child needed correction, feeding, comfort, or instruction. Then came the years when one notices the chair not filled, the chore no longer assigned to a particular son, the daughter whose work now belongs in another household. A parent desires children to grow and go rightly. Still, the going is felt. I had to learn another kind of fatherhood then. When children are small, a father protects and commands. When they are grown, he counsels when asked, prays always, and watches them meet what cannot be met on their behalf. The army had taught me obedience under command. Family taught me the harder restraint of not commanding what no longer belongs under my direct hand. The death of Lou Eva in 1891 lay close behind us as we entered that decade. I do not know whether any parent ever becomes practiced in such sorrow. The older children had their own griefs, and younger ones had to learn that the house could continue after a burial without ceasing to remember. Faith did not remove pain. It gave pain a place to stand without becoming master of the whole house. I had begun life in Lancashire, crossed the Atlantic, and made myself part of American soil. By the 1890s, I had spent many more years in America than in England. Yet old origins do not disappear. They remain in speech, in memory, in the way a man hears certain hymns, in the names of parents and brothers, in the knowledge that he began in one country and would be buried in another. The war had tested my belonging to the United States more severely than any oath of naturalization could have done. After it, Iowa was not merely a place where I farmed. It was part of the country for which I had offered my body. Aging is not only the weakening of the body, it is the gathering of evidence. A man reaches his 60s and begins to see what has endured. Faith endured. Janet endured. The family, though altered by death and marriage and distance, endured. The union endured. The memories endured. The diary I had kept during the war had endured too, though it had not yet been made into the clean copy that would occupy my 70th year.
Looking back from the age of 70, for many years I thought of peace as the opposite of war. That is true, but it is not the whole truth. Peace is also the place where a man learns what war has done to him. In the army, there is too much movement to understand one's own change. The march, the picket, the trench, the boat, the order, the illness, the next place, the next danger. All these keep a man occupied. He knows he is being altered, but he cannot measure it. The measuring comes afterward. It comes when a child asks a simple question and the answer catches in the throat. It comes when flowers are set on graves and a name from 30 years before rises as clearly as yesterday. It comes when a man who once slept in mud finds himself unable to complain honestly about a hard bed. It comes when he sees his children grow older than some soldiers ever became. I learned that the war had not made me larger than other men. It had made me responsible for memory. To have survived is not a decoration. It is a charge. The dead cannot correct the record. The living must do what they can.
By the end of the 1890s, I had before me the papers of a life that had gone farther than the young man from Fox Hill Bank could have imagined. I had crossed the ocean as a boy of about 17. I had worked in a store at Dubuque, farmed in Wisconsin, buried a wife, raised a daughter from that sorrow, married Janet, enlisted at Portage, marched and steamed and fought across the South, returned home, moved by wagon to Iowa, farmed, taught, kept books, assessed property, served Sunday school, buried children, saw children marry and grew old in a country that had itself been remade. The war diary remained. During service, a diary is a tool against forgetting. It holds what a man cannot write fully in letters and cannot trust to memory alone. It notes miles, camps, dates, places, weather, perhaps the names of men and the outlines of maps. It is written under conditions that do not favor beauty. A soldier writes when he can, how he can, with the hand that fatigue permits. As I approached 70, I began to understand that those rough wartime papers were not mine only. They belonged also to the children and to those who would come after them. Not because I had been famous, I had not been. Not because my service had been greater than another man's, it had not been. They mattered because they were a witness. A plain man had gone, had seen, had endured, had returned, and had written enough that the road could still be traced. The long peace had taught me that memory must be tended like land. If neglected, it grows over. If worked faithfully, it may yet feed those who did not plant it. So the chapter of those 34 years closes not with a battle, not with a surrender, not with a discharge paper, but with an old man looking at what he had saved. The house was quieter than it had been when all the children were small. Janet and I had crossed more than 40 years of marriage. Iowa lay around us not as a new country, but as the ground of our age. The war was far behind in years and near at hand in paper. I sat with the old materials before me, the diary, the notes, the memory of maps, the names of rivers and forts and camps. I had not yet begun the clean rewriting. That labor belonged to the next year. But the thought had come close enough to remain. While the hand was steady enough, while the mind could still follow the old roads, while the Lord granted time, I should set the record down again. I did not pick up the pen yet. I looked at the papers and knew that peace had carried the war as far as this desk. The battles were no longer before me as danger, but they were before me as stewardship. If the Lord granted strength, I would order the old road once more, not to return to it, but to leave it truthfully behind.